on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Mental health, unfortunately, has been deteriorating at a social scale for a long time. I would say decades. It has been deteriorating for decades. It used to be a minor problem if we compare it with other problems, like, for example, infectious diseases like centuries ago. But nowadays, it's the first, it's the main cause of disability worldwide. For example, depression or anxiety. Those mental illnesses used to be not so important in the past, but now are major, major in our Western societies. Unfortunately, the modern tools we have for treating or for addressing these illnesses are not always efficacious enough to keep this problem at bay, meaning that a lot of people, yes, they respond well to these treatments, even though they need a long time for having a positive response many times, but a lot of people are not responding to these treatments that we have nowadays. So we are really desperate for finding new tools, new solutions, especially to prevent these mental illnesses or these mental disorders, I would say in a more correct term probably. But we also need tools for also treating them. So we need to prevent them and we need to treat them. And psychedelics are very interesting in both sides.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Anton Gomez Escalar to discuss his book, The Psychedelic Reawakening. Anton talks about the current state and history of psychedelic research, the therapeutic potential for mental health, the challenges of clinical trials for psychedelics, the evolving legal and societal perceptions surrounding these substances, and his vision for a structured, regulated approach to psychedelic use that balances scientific research, public education, and safe access. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Anton Gomez Escalar has a Master's of Science in Psychopharmacology and Drugs, a Master's of Public Health, and a Master's of International Relations. He is a psychopharmacologist who works on psychedelic research, drug education, and harm reduction. He is the founder of Drogopedia, has worked at organizations like Energy Control and the European Union Drug Agency, and has presented on psychedelics at several international forums, including the European Parliament and the United Nations. He is a member of the UNAD Global Drug Policy Commission and co-founder and board member of the Spanish Society of Psychedelic Medicine, the INAWE Foundation for Psychedelic Science, and the Psychedelic Society of Madrid. He joins me today to discuss his book, The Psychedelic Reawakening. Anton, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you very much. It's glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm very excited to speak with you. I really enjoyed your book, and I found it to be a very comprehensive guide of the what's being referred to as the psychedelic renaissance, but it's all based in the science, and you go over what the science is telling us and what the legal status is and things like that. So I found it to be incredibly informative, very, very informative. So I thought that maybe the best place to begin is to ask you to kind of give a bit of an overview of where we are today in regards to psychedelic therapy, psychedelic medicines, and maybe a little bit of the history, you know, where were we and how did we get to where we are today?
So to sum up where we are today, it's kind of long because there is so many things happening, but I think the best way is just to say that we are in a very exciting point in time when it comes to psychedelic research and the development of psychedelic therapies, because many places in the world have started to processes to legalize or to approve medical uses for the substances based on all the science that has been accumulating over the last years, that is becoming quite a big body of research that is pointing towards the direction of the medical use of these substances in many cases. Now there is new waves of research that are starting, new paths. For example, the use of psychedelic substances for neurological diseases, that is something new compared with the other kind of uses that were never explored before, like the mental health treatments like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, addictions. Those are kind of getting quite big in terms of the research that has been published. These new other areas like neurological diseases are starting now. And at the same time, we're also starting to question about the use of these substances in other areas that are not related with mental health in particular. Mm-hmm. For example, like the improvement of people that is already healthy, no? Like these areas that are not only for treatments, but also for prevention, let's say, of mental health future diseases, or also to improve like the self-knowledge of people or the exploration of consciousness. So we have many, many areas of research that has been developing. Also, it's very important to mention all this neuroscience area that we're trying to use these substances as tools to understand how the brain works, how the consciousness works, how consciousness arises, how can we work with consciousness, and why are we human? No, what yeah. makes us human compared with others? All this has been is a movement that started, as many already know, a long time ago. Actually, we can go to the beginning of times of the human species, the start of the yeah. exploration of the mind and the different spiritual realms and uses that these substances had. But if we look at the West, at the Western societies, our interest for psychedelics dates back to the discovery of LSD, maybe a little bit earlier, because we can also talk about mescaline, for example, and Arthur Hefter's discovery of mescaline. That was kind of the first encounter of Western modern science with psychedelics in the late 19th century. But after that, all this movement started to develop with a very strong scientific base and scientific approach. And since the discovery of LSD, that was like the real beginning of the first psychedelic renaissance, we can call it, everything started to become more focused into the use of these substances, especially for the scientific exploration of the mind and also the treatment of these mental health diseases that were increasingly important in Western societies since the middle 20th century, no? Okay. The thing is that as everyone or a lot of people in this space already knows, we had this horrible crackdown of the psychedelic research that happened in the late 60s, early 70s, that was mainly because of the social use of the substances or the out-of-the-lab use of the substances that became kind of threatening for the elites or the political elites at the moment. They saw this as a very disruptive substance that could make people question authority and more rebel and things like that. So this was like the kind of the beginning of this crackdown that lasted for almost 30 years, no? Since the early 70s until almost the early 2000s, where everything started again, as in this second psychedelic renaissance, that is what we call today the psychedelic renaissance, shortening the name, no? But it's really the second psychedelic renaissance, right, at least for Western societies. Other societies in the world, maybe they didn't have a psychedelic renaissance because they didn't have a psychedelic disappearance at any point. So they are still in their psychedelic era, let's say, no? We are restarting again for a second time this exploration. The interesting thing about all this is that we have known these tools for a very, very long time, but actually they have been always surrounded in Western societies by this controversy always, no? That these substances were kind of dangerous. They didn't have as many uses as they were expecting them to have. But now we're rediscovering that these substances really have very important uses, not only for these scientific areas, but also for the therapeutic and especially for the discovery of what is the human mind and where is the consciousness coming from. So there are many, many areas of exploration that are really interesting to be research these days, and thanks God we are in an era that this is becoming very trendy, very big. All the major scientific journals, all the major scientific research groups are getting interested in these specific substances for all these different uses. So we are in a very interesting point in time for being into this area. So I'm happy that we're all interested about these topics, yeah, because it's what is trending now, what is going to be very big in the near future.
Yeah. Thank you. I know it was a huge question to ask because there is so much history there. But I think that kind of what I want to do is maybe focus on a few of the aspects that you just touched upon. And one of those, I think, is that psychedelics for the longest time have had a bad reputation. And in popular culture, put it that way, and the understanding of non-scientists. And often that understanding is completely unfounded. And so it seems to me that it might be important to maybe address some of the stereotypes because, for example, we've heard before that, psychedelics can drive you crazy. They will make you insane. And, there's just some absolutely ridiculous stories that I've heard, like someone started to believe that they were an orange or something, and then they continued to believe it. So maybe we could kind of look at why psychedelics are not as dangerous as the common conception is, but also how, in what ways are they being shown to help in therapy, in psychotherapy?
So first of all, I would like to address the point that, of course, psychedelics, as any other psychoactive substance we know, have risk. And this means that there is a possibility, a probability, I would say a certain probability, of having negative output after using them. Now, this is something that could happen with any psychedelic, well, any, sorry, psychoactive substance we know, even the ones that are sold for medical uses and everything. So this is not something especially for psychedelics. It's something that happens with all psychoactive substances, being that caffeine, nicotine, or whatever we think about. But it's true that psychedelics, the main risk that they might have is when it comes to people that have a predisposition for certain psychotic disorders. No, this, fortunately, this is not very common in society. So it's a very small percentage of people that can have these psychotic outcomes of use for using psychedelics. And this is something that could happen not only for using psychedelics. This could happen for someone skipping a night's sleep, having a romantic breakup, having someone dying in their life. So everything that has an estrescent capability can make these people have these experiences, meaning that this is not as a problem only of psychedelics. This is something that could happen with any other experience or substance that can induce some certain amount of stress in the person, no? But this is a very small percentage of people. And on the other hand, we have a lot of possibilities for positive uses for psychedelic substances, not only in, for example, the recreational area, that we know that there's been a very wide use of psychedelics as a recreational tool, but especially when it comes to mental health. Mental health, unfortunately, has been deteriorating at a social scale for a long time. I would say decades. It has been deteriorating for decades. It used to be a minor problem if we compare it with other problems, like, for example, infectious diseases, like centuries ago. But nowadays, is the main cause of disability worldwide. For example, depression or anxiety. Those mental illnesses used to be not so important in the past, but now are major in our Western societies. Unfortunately, the modern tools we have for treating or for addressing these illnesses are not always efficacious enough to keep this problem at bay, meaning that a lot of people, yes, they respond well to these treatments, even though they need a long time for having a positive response many times. But a lot of people are not responding to these treatments that we have nowadays. So we are really desperate for finding new tools, new solutions, especially to prevent these mental illnesses or these mental disorders, I would say in a more correct term, probably. But we also need tools for also treating them. So we need to prevent them and we need to treat them. And psychedelics are very interesting in both sides. First of all, we can have improvements in some of the realms that are underscoring the mental health status of a person by having these kind of experiences in a way that are targeting the development or the development of the person. I mean, this has been shown in many studies from people, for example, that have been in psychedelic using communities for a long time, that there is an improvement in all the realms of mental resilience, for example. So the capability of keeping mental sickness at bay or keeping healthy over the long time. But also psychedelics, and this is the most revolutionary area of psychedelic research in the last decades, psychedelics has been proven to be very efficacious when it comes to treating mental health disorders that are already there, no? For example, anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or addictions, no? Those mental mental disorders are very difficult to treat in an efficacious way when it comes to big populations, as it's happening right now. No? A lot of people having these disorders. And it's very expensive as well. It's very resource consuming to have these treatments because they need a lot of people, a lot of therapies. They need a lot of medications, a long time to have a good response. But with psychedelics, we can address most of these limitations. No? We can have a very efficacious treatments, very fast acting treatments, and they have a very long lasting effects in the individual, meaning that instead of needing like a person that is constantly taking a pill every day, we can have a long lasting mental health benefit with just a few exposures to the drug in very good conditions. And I mean like very well controlled set and setting. It's something very important that we know since the first psychedelic renaissance, that is it's a core element of the psychedelic experience. And also, of course, having this therapeutic approach, meaning that the psychedelic experience is done in a therapeutic context with a good preparation, good screening to prevent people with these mental disorders that might be more dangerous to get in touch with psychedelics, and also very good integration afterwards, because most of the therapy that it comes with psychedelics is happening right after the psychedelic experience. It's not happening during, right. It's happening right after most of the times in what is known as the psychedelic integration, where you take all the experiences that have arise during the psychedelic experience and you integrate them into the person's life in order to have a positive benefit overall, a positive impact in their life and in their condition.
Okay, wonderful.
So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
So, yes, I was going to say that. So nowadays, the most developed area and the most promising area is the area of psychedelic therapy. But as I was saying before, also the uses of psychedelics to prevent these kind of situations even to arise in the first place. So keep using psychedelics as a preventive intervention or even as a spiritual or a self-development tool are also very interesting, because this can help us not to treat the problem but also to prevent the problem in the first place. And in this area also, I think it's very interesting to think about the capacity of psychedelics, not only in the psychological area, but also in the neurological area. So the possibilities of psychedelics to improve neurological health by activating one of the most important processes that we have in the human brain and in most animal brains, that is neuroplasticity processes, the capacity of the brain to rearrange its networks and to adapt to the environment or to any change or to any change that is needed. So by using psychedelics as tools for neurological health, we could in the future develop treatments that may prevent the development of, for example, of neurodegenerative diseases. That is a very big problem nowadays, and unfortunately we don't have effective treatments for that. And being able to activate these neuroplasticity processes, or even to activate neurogenesis, that is the birth of new neurons in the brain, we can eventually develop treatments to prevent these problems from happening in the first place. And this is very important, because nowadays we don't have any tool actually that is effective enough to treat Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, or even the problems that arise after a seizure or a stroke, sorry, that it can make the person have a neurological problem that is long lasting sometimes.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I have an aunt who currently has dementia. And I have often thought that psychedelic substances could help people with Alzheimer's and dementia and whatnot, specifically because of the neuroplasticity, and maybe help change the recreate new connections in the brain and whatnot.
Yeah, and also because psychedelics has been shown to reduce neuroinflammation, which is also very difficult to target and to address, because the tools that we use nowadays for targeting this neuroinflammation sometimes include the use of some steroids that can diminish the immunological capacity of the entire body. So we can pay a very high price by trying to target neuroinflammation, and the person can get other illnesses because of the treatment. But in the case of psychedelics, this effect appears to be quite specific, targeting neuroinflammation in particular, and not having a very big impact in the immune system, in the overall body. And this is a very nice property. Unfortunately, all this still needs a lot of research. We are in early stages of this kind of lines of research. But anyway, this is very, very promising because it's pointing us to a direction of the use of psychedelics in many different situations related with mental health or with the neurological health that nowadays we don't have enough tools to address.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of curious, since we're talking about the brain, there are, again, still some things that I want to follow up on. But since we're kind of talking about the brain, I think that it's interesting, the research that's been done, how psychedelics affect the brain. And I'm thinking in a couple of different ways. Is one, there's that sort of lock and key mechanism, and there seems to be a place specifically in the brain for psychedelic substances. But also my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that, you know, it used to be thought that if you like took a psychedelic, the way I described it is your brain would be on fire in the sense that, you know, it'd be more active, but it seems to be the opposite, that the brain's actually kind of quieting down, but at the same time acting more holistically. Do I have that right?
Well, kind of. let me clarify a little bit. Yeah. Well, the thing is that we used to think that when you took a psychedelic, you have an overall activation of the brain. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's what we thought it was happening. Mm-hmm. But what we saw in neuroimaging studies is that there is actually a quieting of a specific area of the brain that is very important because it's an area of the brain that is central to a lot of processes that is called the default mode network. The default mode network that is connecting different areas of the brain, and it has a lot of very important roles in consciousness, I would say. It's an area that, for example, is very activated when we are not doing nothing in particular. We are not engaging in a specific activity. No? For example, when we are like daydreaming or thinking about our thoughts or whatever. In that situation, the default mode networks tend to be very overactive. No, this in people that have like some mental disorders like anxiety, or addictions, or depressions, tends to be overactivated as compared with healthy people. No, what happens when you disconnect this area of the brain, or when you destabilize this area of the brain, is that the other areas of the brain that usually are inhibited or controlled by this default mode network, this central system, these areas become more chaotic, chaotic, and instead of having a specific structure and order in the way they communicate, they start communicating each other in a more anarchical way. No, so we have first this deactivation of this central area of the brain that is connecting different areas, but in those areas that used to be more controlled, now we have an overactivity, and especially more than an overactivity, I would say we have a more chaotic pattern of communication. And this translates into a more unified way for the brain to work. So instead of having, for example, the visual cortex just working on visual perception, then suddenly we are seeing images by using the entire cortex of the brain. So that's why we have all these visual hallucinations, because we have entire areas of the brain that were not commonly connected with vision that now are connected with vision. No, so we have this more chaotic way of working for the brain. But I find this very interesting because if we go for the theories that try to explain what happens in the brain under the influence of psychedelics, we have many very interesting theories. But I really like the theories that have been proposed by the researcher Robin Carhart-Harris. He has a few theories to explain what's happening. No, one of those theories is the anarchic brain that talks about the entropic brain that talks about how the entropy of the brain increases when we are under the influence of a psychedelic, and we go towards a more entropic state of mind. No, and he defines entropic states of mind. For example, psychosis is a high entropy state of mind. In the other side, we have like very rigid states of mind that are the lowest entropy possible. For example, obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety. So we are like changing the volume, I would say, or the temperature of the brain into a more heated state that allows for changes to happen, allows for a more malleable brain for us to be able to modify it or to mold it in a different form. It's like a metal that you heat up and it becomes liquid, so you can reshape it before it dries and becomes again, it cools down, sorry, and becomes again a solid piece of metal. So it's a very interesting way of seeing this kind of state, no? But what we have is that this interconnection of different areas of the brain that happens precisely because this area of the brain that is in charge of keeping order disappears temporarily and allows for a more chaotic state to emerge. That is much more similar to the way our brain works when we are young children, no? For example. So we have a more entropic way of seeing the world, more magical thinking way of seeing the world. And we have a more heated state of mind, allowing us to have a more creative way of seeing the world. But in the other hand, this is less is more energy consuming state. No, it is not so well developed for survival. It's more for learning, no? For learning, for discovering the world, for building our core beliefs, for building our models of how the world works. But once we start growing up, we need to stop being into these states and transition into a more cold, rigid, and moral states, because those are the states that allow us to act over the world, to work, to do the things, to focus on things, to be more effective in world, no? So we are in a very in a we transition from a very for a not very efficient state of mind where we are wasting a lot of resources. We are into a much more efficient state of mind that is better for survival, but is much worse when it comes to learning new things. So that's the reason we have this original state, because it's better for learning, and we transition into the other one. Sometimes during our lifetime, we need to restart or reactivate these mechanisms again to have the possibility to readapt ourselves to the world that has been changing around us. And in order to access this state is where psychedelics are very interesting tools, because we are able to activate again these mechanisms that are present during childhood to allow us to reconnect with the world, to relearn about the world, and to change our beliefs, no? To take the beliefs that are dysfunctional or that are making us suffer, for example, beliefs about self-worth or not being worthy enough or love or whatever, and to change that belief into a more adaptive belief that doesn't make us suffer or doesn't make us be into a pathological state like depression, for example, no? So in this is the reason that I think psychedelics can be so interesting for psychological situations, to address psychological diseases or psychological problems, no?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it reminds me, I didn't write it down. I almost wrote it down when I was jotting down all my notes from your book. But there was a quote from Albert Hofmann, who, of course, is the person who synthesized LSD, that, and again, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like that it was there to help us become who we truly were meant to be.
Yeah. It's one of the things that he said. He said many, many interesting things. He's a very interesting scientist because he's a scientist, but on the other side, he's also very spiritual as well. So he has like a very philosophical and spiritual development. He's not like a hard science guy. He's a mystical scientist. He's a very interesting guy.
Well, and I think that's something that's very interesting in the sense of psychedelics is that it brings in the mystical to the scientific in a sense. And I noted, see if I can find it here, but in the book you noted that the mystical experience is an important part of the therapeutic process.
Yes, it is.
Why?
Well, this is a very interesting debate, I would say, because there is still some debate around this idea of mystical experience being central to the therapeutic effect of psychedelics. And it's true that from a pure pharmaceutical approach, this for many people is nonsense. I mean, they all think that the efficacy of psychedelics is based mainly in their neurological effects, and that's something that is going to happen regardless the experience that the person have, no? That they regard the experience as a side effect, they would say, no? As a hallucinogenic properties of psychedelics are considered to be side effects of psychedelics, and they don't want to have them like into the treatment. So they are trying, for example, to develop psychedelics who don't have these hallucinogenic effects, no? But on the other hand, a lot of research, especially research coming from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, has always pointed to the idea that having a mystical experience, so having an experience that has a certain qualities that connected with the feeling of oneness, the connection with the universe or other beings, the dissolution of the ego of the person, all these things happening are very correlated with the therapeutical effect of the psychedelic itself, meaning that if you don't achieve this level of experience, your likelihood of having a long-lasting therapeutic effect decreases compared with people that have achieved this experience. And it's very interesting because even people having like same doses of the psychedelic, the ones that achieve this level of experience are more connected with this therapeutical effect towards, meanwhile, sorry, the other people that are having the same dose but not achieving this level of experience don't tend to have this therapeutic effect afterwards. So there is something in the mystical experience, something in the experience itself, in the experience of the psychedelics, or the subjective experience that is very connected with the meaningful or with the good therapeutic effect afterwards, no? And to me, that makes a lot of sense because I always frame this as compared with a trauma, but in the positive side of the trauma. So let's say, for example, you can have a negative trauma, for example, if you are part of a violent event or a natural disaster, or you are being raped, or whatever happens to you, you can have a negative trauma. But I can also think that there is the possibility of having a positive trauma if the person experienced a really positive experience, feeling, or idea that was not entertained before in his head. No, and this is what happens, in my opinion, during the mystical experience. No, it's like having a positive event that gives you like a lot of sense of meaning and things that were not there before. So the pharmacological effect of the substance cannot account for this specific positive idea or psychological experience that you are having. It's the facilitator, of course. I mean, the substance is facilitating you to experience this. But for example, the same person having the same dose of the same substance, if he has a very positive, intense experience that can be into this mystical experience level, or if the same person with the same substance at the same dose has a negative experience or has an experience that is not as intense as the mystical experience, this person is not going to have those positive outcomes or not going to have these therapeutic outcomes. So to me, the idea that what you experience during this hallucinogenic state is very related with what happens afterwards with your mental health is very natural. I think that's the way we should be approaching this. Unfortunately, for the industry, for the pharmaceutical industry, sometimes this is more out of their hands. And if it's out of their hands, they are not so much interested into this in particular. So they try to frame psychedelics as the substance that activates the 5-HT2A receptor and make this effect into the neuron networks. But they trying to undermine or they trying to not give a lot of importance to the subjective psychological experience that the person is having. And I think, in my opinion, that's very important. That experience is very important into what happens afterwards in the person.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes it seem that there's a fundamental difference with the psychedelics because I think the modern sort of Western idea is that if someone is given a drug for, you know, like depression or anxiety, that it's going to affect everybody the same way.
Yeah.
But psychedelics don't. And that seems like it would cause a challenge for studying psychedelics.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a big challenge, and actually it makes some of the basic science of health, for example, pharmacology, they kind of can have some threat from these ideas, because this is taking the power of the output out of their hands and is putting in another realm, in this case the realm of psychology in particular, or the experience or the emotional experience or the psychological experience of the person. And I think this is probably one of the reasons that psychedelics has taken so much time to get developed in the Western world, because science in particular is quite afraid of things that they cannot control or they cannot especially predict. And in this case, it's very difficult to predict sometimes what's going to happen when someone takes a psychedelic. So in modern pharmacology, I mean, the possibility to predict what's going to happen, to adapt the dose, to have the knowledge beforehand is very important, because it allows you to personalize the treatment, to make the treatment more precise to the person, to the condition, to whatever you want to achieve. But in the case of psychedelics, there's always a certain level of uncertainty that is going to be difficult to address and to diminish. So we're going to have always some uncertainty, and that uncertainty is something that I think this approach we're having now is very afraid of, especially in medicine. In medicine, doctors don't like to be like faced with uncertainty whenever they're prescribing a treatment. Either if you are playing with a substance that can fix or help the person improve in their condition, but in the other hand, they can make the person more anxious or have a very bad experience or having a really difficult mo time, that kind of uncertainty is not something that modern medicine is very comfortable with.
Yeah, and my understanding is that there are some other challenges in the sense of just testing
Yes.
psychedelics from the model that, sort of the gold standard, the standard for most medications is the double-blind experiment. But that psychedelics are problematic in that it's very difficult to have that, achieve that blindness.
Yes, it's very difficult. And unfortunately, this is something that, in my opinion, is impossible to fix. Like, we cannot blind people. I mean, it's super difficult. There are new approaches to try to imitate that blinding. For example, they are using psychedelics in people that is sleeping, or they are using psychedelics in people that are sedated for a surgical intervention, for example. In that way, it's more difficult for the person to know if they have had psychedelics during the time they were sedated or not. And that way, you can more or less achieve kind of a blindness. But that kind of design, in my opinion, provides a lot of limitations, because, for example, if we are accepting that the psychological subjective experience of the person during the psychedelic experience is very important, if you are giving that substance to someone that is under the effects of an anesthetic, for example, you are only looking at the effects that are happening in the neuronal networks, but the psychedelic experience is not developing for the person. The person is unconscious, so it's not gonna you're gonna achieve a very imperfect effect when it comes to therapy. So in my opinion, the problem of blinding is something that unfortunately we cannot perfectly address. The only way we can address it is by accepting that there's going to be some level of uncertainty regarding the effect of the substance or the efficacy of the substance. There's going to be always a role for the placebo effect that is going to be there. And for us, it's going to be very difficult to just perfectly account for that specific amount of effect that is coming, not from the substance, but from the expectation, for example, no? But if we look in the real world, if we go do real world science and don't go to the perfect experimental situations that the modern research try always to emulate, no? For example, these double-blind placebo control trials. If we go for a more real-world kind of designs, and we see that a particular group of people that is having this treatment is improving their health in a much faster and much efficacy way that other people that is having other kind of mental health approaches, then we can tolerate that there is a certain amount of placebo effect, but the effects that we are seeing, if we compare these groups, are big enough for us to think that there is something more important than the placebo effect that is back there pushing these people to get better when it comes to their mental health conditions, no? So I think instead of looking into the rigorous, perfectionist, reductionist hard science when it comes to trying to discount for the placebo effect in the case of psychedelics, that, as I told you, is very difficult because of the blindness thing, is very difficult. we should just accept this level of uncertainty, but understand that if we are seeing improvements that are in the range of 70%, 80% of people getting better, this probably is not only because of placebo effect. There is something
Right.
else there that is really, really working very well, no? So unfortunately, this is something that is very difficult that science is going to do in a short term, because it requires a change in the way that the effect of the substance is understood in science. But in my opinion, it's the only way out of this problem, because if you require a perfect blindness for approving, for example, the use of psychedelics in mental health, then is never going to happen, because we're never
Right.
going to have a perfect blinding technique for psychedelics, because there's always going to be big limitations whenever we try to blind psychedelics.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, it's a fundamental problem that modern science is going to need to face by changing a little bit the procedures or the requirements that are being used for psychedelics. Otherwise, we won't get out of this situation ever.
Yeah. My understanding, and again, I could be wrong on this, so please correct me if you know, but my understanding is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies here in the US, they do a lot of the trial work, and they've been doing a lot of studies with MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder. And the FDA, I think it was just last summer, rejected them because the studies didn't meet that standard of double blind. But like you said, it's impossible. You know, if someone is given a psychedelic, they know the blindness goes away.
It's going to be very difficult to fix that. The problem with MDMA and the approval was not just the blindness. It was one of the problems. That's true.
Okay.
It was one of the main concerns. But there were also other concerns happening there. But the thing is, there are techniques nowadays that are being proposed to try to fix this situation. In my opinion, all of them are going to have big limitations. For example, the one I told you about, the anesthesia, having people anesthesiated, and then that way they are unable to know. For example, MAPS has been using a lot, MAPS and other research organizations have been using a lot, for example, niacin, that is B3 vitamin, that makes you flush and become red in your skin and makes you feel like hot and weird. So that can a little bit make people confused whether they are taking a psychedelic or not. But in my opinion, it's not enough. I mean, it's not enough to really make someone believe that they are under the effect of psychedelics. Or for example, there are new techniques being proposed. For example, virtual reality. Virtual reality, you can give your virtual reality to both groups, and that way it's very difficult for the person that doesn't get the psychedelic to know if they are tripping or not tripping, because the virtual reality is confusing them. But in my opinion, that technique is also imperfect as well, because maybe we find out that these chaotic states that can be brought by the virtual reality are also helping this person to achieve these therapeutic outcomes. So your technique for blinding is also helping the placebo group to become better, and that way you are making the effect of the substance less noticeable. No? So always there's limitations. So unfortunately, I think this is a fundamental problem that is going to be need to tackle by changing what are you requiring and your understanding of the effect of a substance. Because if you know more or less what is the amount of effect that you get by using a placebo in the real world, because we have a lot of studies, we know like what is the percentage of effect that you get usually by placebo, then you can more or less predict what amount of placebo effect you are getting in the psychedelic group, and you can discount that placebo effect into the total efficacy of the psychedelic group, and then you can compare. So if I know that more or less the placebo effect is going to account for, I don't know, 20 or 30% of the people that is going to get well or recover after getting the substance, I can subtract that 30%, and still I will have that the psychedelic group is getting better, way better than the placebo group. So I think that is a way that we can use to achieve that. The problem is that this is neither perfect, so it's also having limitations. But I think science in that regard needs to understand that in order for these very promising treatments to keep advancing into the process of being authorized for medical use, we need to somehow understand or accept that it's going to be very difficult to have a really good blind. But if we see at the real world and what happens with psychedelics when you do big studies in people, I think the efficacy we see is big enough to understand or to accept that there is some certain level of placebo effect that is going to be inside that effect. And even taking that out, it's still going to be much better than the other treatments that we have, no? So unfortunately, as I told you, it's something that we're not going to be able to perfectly
right.
fix.
Yeah. Well, my concern was really the kind of legal aspect, because it seems that the scheduling of the psychedelic substances initially, it's not based on science. You know, the psychedelics are some of the physically, yeah, the scheduling, the psychedelics are some of the safest substances that there are, and they're safer than a lot of legal substances. But it seems that governments are going to have to rethink scheduling and rethink how they determine what is acceptable and what can be used as treatment. And it just seems that there's this weird mix of, you know, the science and the governing within this. Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, scheduling has been something that was not traditionally very connected with science or with
right.
public health. It was more connected with the moral approach to drugs. You know? So, for example, as the Western world is a Christian world in a sense. I mean, it's not so much nowadays, but the moral basis that we have are from Christianity in
right.
particular. And for example, the substances that are sacred for us, sacred in that sense, for example, is alcohol, because alcohol is present in the mass, in what we understand like the blood of Jesus Christ. So
right.
we attach that holy level, I mean, that sacred property to alcohol, but to the other substances that might be sacred for other cultures or religions, we attach the idea of being like sinful, demoniac, or dangerous. So it's based mostly, unfortunately, on the social perception or the cultural perception of the substance, and not with having like a very good analysis of the toxicology or the addiction potential of the substance that should be the essence of the scheduling. No? How toxic is the substance? How addictive is the substance? How many troubles can this substance make in modern societies? And not so much what we think the substance is more or less dangerous. For example, if we check out like the scores of danger of the substances that were developed by a group of researchers, which we compare with them with the level of scheduling, we have a very mixed table. It's not connected the way it should be, no? And we also have like very, very weird and very funny situations at having some of the most legal substances that are being like the most dangerous and more harmful for societies and for the individual people, compared with others that are way less dangerous, but are like subject to the most and the biggest controls of all of them. So these schedulings need to be revised. And I think the entire drug classification system needs to be revised, because, for example, even the most prohibited substances or the more controlled substances, we don't see that in the real world. Placing them in a very restrictful list makes people take them less or makes people have less harm. Actually, it's quite the opposite sometimes. When you put a substance in a very restrictive scheduling, what it happens is that the harms associated with that substance trend to increase. Because, for example, you have adulteration, you have more crime connected with the drug trafficking of that substance, you have a lot of money, dark money that is making like the corrupting the system. So all that things are side effects of prohibiting substances in the classic or traditional way. So I think we should rethink the entire drug classification and the entire drug scheduling system. But especially when it comes to psychedelics, what we need to do is to make them as accessible as possible for research mostly, and to make research have easy time getting into psychedelics, because that way we're going to have a faster, easier, and cheaper research that is going to have a positive impact in human health, in the development of all these new tools for mental health and for neurological health. And unfortunately, nowadays, the way these substances are classified or are scheduled make them really difficult for researchers to access or to research. I trying to agree that substances need to be controlled somehow, because all psychoactive substances of any kind, and also psychedelic substances, but all of the psychoactive substances that we can find, for example, in the drugs wheel model, that is the model that we are using the book to classify all the psychoactive drugs that we know. Psychedelics is just one of the families of this entire drugs psychoactive system. All those substances, in my opinion, need to be subject to some form of control, because we should not be naive and think that drugs are harmless. All drugs can have this risk and can be dangerous in certain people, in certain situations, in certain doses. But I also think that we need to facilitate knowledge with the system that we choose to put into place, not facilitate taboo, stigma, and all these things that harm a lot of people as a side effect. And also, we need to find a balance between keeping society safe or people safe, and also allowing for the development of the very big therapeutic effects that we can find in some psychoactive substances, and in psychedelics in particular, to be accessible for society and for medical doctors and for everyone that is in need for them. In a safe and a controlled way, no? So I think we should rebalance this scheduling system again. And of course, psychedelics should not be in any situation at the bottom of the list of the ones that are, let's say, more accessible for science. No, they should be at the top list of the more accessible for science. So I'm not talking about social accessibility. I'm talking about mostly scientific accessibility. And I hope that in future, if people have good knowledge of these substances and the public education improves, then we can think about having more social accessibility to these substances. But first of all, knowledge should be there, and for knowledge to be there, we should let science have a better access to these substances in order to be producing this knowledge about the safety, about the efficacy, about the way to predict the effects of the substances, and to optimize and maximize the positive outcomes from these substances by getting more scientific knowledge. And later, when people have this knowledge on hand, and we have achieved this knowledge by science, we can start thinking about if we're going to let people have a better accessibility to the substances or not, no?
Okay. Yeah. There's something I want to ask about that, but first, it's really interesting. I've had Tim Reed on the program before, and he is heading up psychedelic therapy training in the UK. I forget off the top of my head what college. I'm going to say Imperial College in London, but I could be wrong on that. So all apologies, Tim. But the people, these are therapists who are training to use psychedelics in therapy, and part of the program is that they need to also have the psychedelic experience, but they have to go out of country to do that. But then it also seems like that we're in this situation where we're training people to eventually, hopefully, be able to use these substances in a therapeutic setting. But right now, the laws are such that we simply can't.
Yeah, and for example, last spring, on April 2024, I was invited by the European Medicines Agency, and along with other psychedelic researchers and psychedelic therapists and people in the psychedelic area, for a very nice big meeting that they organized in their headquarters in Amsterdam. And the topic that we were talking about was the future of psychedelic law in Europe. So how is the law going to be structured? What are we going to require to psychedelic therapists to be able to work with these substances? What is going to be the level of scheduling or the level of control of psychedelics in an eventual authorization of the medical use? No? So all these questions are still on the table, and for the most part, those questions have not been addressed in any area of the world. If we look, for example, at Australia, that is one of the countries that have gotten one step ahead of the rest of the world by letting the psychiatrist use the substances for the treatment of depression in the case of psilocybin, and the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in the case of MDMA. This was not a formal approval either. So it was not approval that was made by the medicine regulation body of the country. It was a political thing. It was a political move, meaning that we still don't know how it's gonna be regulated in the world. What are gonna be the perfect systems to keep these substances accessible for the therapist, and what kind of level of training are we gonna require the therapist to have? Because this is something that for me is very important to know. A lot of people now is investing a lot of money in getting into very expensive sometimes psychedelic trainings for therapists, but we don't even know if that titles they're gonna
Right.
get are gonna be useful in the future. Maybe they approve it and it's only accessible for the psychiatrist, and then all the therapists that are not psychiatrists that got this training are not gonna do anything. Maybe it's gonna be open for a lot of different mental health professionals to have access to these tools. So we don't know, and it's still very chaotic everything, no? In my opinion, of course, in a future regulation of this work with these substances, I think, for example, having these self experiences would be very, very valuable, something probably needed. But this could be very, very new in psychiatry or in mental health, because as far as I know, there's no interventions that you are required to have taken in yourself before
Right.
being able to prescribe them in others, no? So this is another change that is going to be made in the backbone of how therapy works in the Western world, because this is completely new. You don't require a psychiatrist to have taken SSRIs before prescribing them. So this is completely new in a sense, and this is very, very interesting challenge that we're gonna face now. Now, how these substances are gonna be accessible, for whom, what are gonna be the requirements, especially because this is very new in it changes a lot of things, no? When you approve, for example, an antidepressant, that antidepressant is probably gonna work as a pill that the doctor is gonna prescribe you to take every day, and you're gonna be able to go to the pharmacy to get it and to take it home every day, and that's gonna be. But these substances are requiring the entire system to change, because you need the doctor or the therapist or whoever is gonna work with the substances to be with the patient for a lot of hours straight, like just working on the experience. They're gonna require a faster meeting in order to have all this integration right afterwards, and not being waiting 4 months to have another appointment in order to get the so they're gonna require the entire system to change. So that's a very big challenge, very, very challenge, because even having very nice efficacies and very good safety profiles, if you need the entire medical system to change just to accommodate the use of these substances, then the challenge is much more than just being worried about the efficacy or the safety, no? That is it used to be the only challenges that the pharmaceuticals had to overcome before being approved. In this case, you need to overcome many more things. The accessibility, for example, the money, how expensive is going to be this treatment? Are going to be insurances covering it? Not public systems, for example, in the case of Europe, are going to be covering these expensive treatments in terms of time consumed by and the need of doctors to be with the patients. So there are many, many unknown things, unfortunately, because I wish these things were going faster than they are actually going. But well, at least things are going forward, even though they are not as fast and as straight. Sometimes they're having a little bit of backwards, like that happens as happening in some countries with the change in laws. But anyway, I think this is unstoppable, fortunately enough, but it's going to take time to adapt for the system, no? So we will see in the beginning a very minor accessibility. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be only for some minorities of people, maybe, well, minorities, rich people, mainly probably in the first place. And then until the system adapts to it and makes these treatments more accessible. This is, for example, what is happening with ketamine. Ketamine is accessible nowadays, but unfortunately, it's very expensive still in most cases. In Spain, for example, is free because the public system is covering it. But anyway, it's not something that you find in every hospital, because it requires a lot of time. It requires the psychiatrist to be working with you instead of just half an hour to give you just the prescription and to talk a little bit with you. It requires him to be like 3 or 4 hours with you, and this is making problems. This is becoming problematic for the system. So there's all this adaptation that still needs to be happening, and it's going to take a long time, unfortunately.
Well, it seems also that pharmaceutical companies may not be horribly interested in supporting a medicine that you don't have to take every day, that you can
Yeah.
take once and then, spend some time with your therapist. And it seems to me that the way that they may respond to that is to make it incredibly expensive.
Yes, and also the substances are, most of them that have a big margin of patentability, meaning that
Right.
they are very old substances or natural substances, and in order to patent them, you have to patent, for example, the delivery system, like
Yeah.
a capsule or whatever, and that doesn't allows you to have like a really big margin of benefit, for example, because if you are charging like $10,000, for example, for
Yeah.
a substance that you can find in nature for free, then
Right.
there's going to be a lot of piracy. You know, a lot of people is
Yeah.
going to just go to the nature, take the substance, and have it like the treatment for free. So this is also a big challenge for this pharmaceutical industry as well to adapt. And in my opinion, the what is going to happen is that we're going to see more of a hybrid system. So instead of pharmaceuticals developing substances to be prescribed by a doctor and to be taken every day, we're going to see that the pharmaceutical companies in the psychedelic area are going to be always connected with the clinical side and the part that is doing all this preparation, this clinical approach, and the delivery of the substance, no? So I think the new companies that are going to be making big profits from psychedelics, those companies are always going to be have one step also, one foot, sorry, in the clinics that are going to be delivering these substances. So that way, because the money in the psychedelic therapy is not in the substance, is in the time that you
Right.
need a therapist to be with you, is in the delivery, in the preparation, in all the setting that is surrounding the delivery of the psychedelic and the psychedelic experience. So that there is where the money is. If a psychedelic, sorry, if ketamine therapy is expensive, it's not because ketamine is expensive, because ketamine is not very expensive. Ketamine is quite cheap, actually. What is expensive is having like a psychiatrist with you, like for a quite a few hours, no, just to
Right.
following you and providing you all a therapist, depending on the part of the therapy that you are providing, no? For example, in the integration, it's perfectly possible and perfectly nice to have a therapist like a psychologist instead of a psychiatrist, because psychologists sometimes are better for when it comes to having like the psychotherapy. So I think that the money is going to be in the delivery, in the setting, not so much in the substance. So companies wanting to make money in the psychedelic revolution probably are going to be companies that are going to merge somehow the clinical and the delivery, the clinical and the pharmaceutical sides in the same kind of complex, no? That's my prediction, or the way I think things going forward.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I do want to ask you about, and you've touched on this, but I kind of wanted to go back to this, is the sort of the spiritual or self-exploration, the personal use, because it just personally, if we get to a point where psychedelic therapies are more readily available and affordable, and someone's like, I would really like, I feel okay mentally, I feel okay, psychologically, but I would really like to utilize this spiritually or for self-exploration. I can imagine, I personally would not want to go to a kind of clinical setting. And I'm just kind of curious. I can think of some alternatives to this is, like maybe having professional sitters that can come to your house where you're more comfortable to just be there in case you need them or something. But how would you envision people who want to explore this, or even, a philosopher who's like, yeah, I kind of want to see what this tells me about consciousness itself. What might that look like?
Well, to me, that would be a second step in
Yeah.
the development of psychedelics, because I think we have to understand that what is more pressing now and more
Yeah.
important and more urgent for many people is like to tackle the therapeutic side of it, like to treat like mental conditions. But I think that the natural second step is to understand that these substances don't require only people that is having mental disorder. You can also, of course, benefit from them without being sick in the first place or without being in a clinical condition. So I totally agree with you in that regard. And the way I envision this is that I think as psychedelics become like a better research substances, we get and acquire more and more knowledge, and we start using them in a therapeutic way, and we start to even learn more and more how to optimize them in therapy and how safe they are or how or what are the dangers and everything. I think that then we should start working on a better informed society, people having more information about the substances, and probably start thinking about how to develop these models that allow for interested people, that could be any case, like people like having spiritual interest, people having wanting to have this experience for whatever reason, to have a way to access these substances, no? And the way I see this is that I think that we could develop centers, places with professional sitters, as you were saying, where you could go there and have these experiences in a very well-controlled setting, in a way that you can more or less have a certainty that things are going to be very well controlled. You're not going to have like a dangerous situation for yourself or for others. So there's people to control you, or you can also have the model that you were mentioning. No, people like even coming to your places, certified trip sitters that can go to a place and prepare you and that. But I think that there we should allow in the second step of the psychedelic revolution, we should allow for people to have access to the substances in a well-controlled way. Maybe even in the future, we can also allow people to have self-exploration alone if they can demonstrate that they have had like a certain number of experiences being controlled by other people. For example, as you do nowadays for skydiving, no? When you do a skydiving, you first of all need to prove that you have certain jumps with an instructor, and then you can acquire a license for doing it yourself. So I think the way I see these things, and people always laugh about this idea, but I think it's a nice idea in my opinion, is like as a driving license. I mean, you can get an exam, like a theoretical exam, that you to demonstrate that you know a lot about the experience, the dangers, what can go well, that can go wrong, what to expect, everything, all the safety measures, all the harm reduction measures. You can also have like a medical examination to demonstrate that you are mentally in a good situation for doing this, that you are not prone to addiction, prone to psychosis, whatever. And then you can also have like a certain way of certifying that you have had, I don't know, 5 psychedelic experiences, 10 psychedelic experiences, and then you can achieve a second level license that allows you for solo tripping or whatever. So I see this as a way of controlling in a very progressive way, like little by little, getting more and more knowledge, getting more and more certification in order to get into these areas. No, I know that this sounds for many people very funny, you know, like having like the drug license or whatever, but in my opinion, it's a good way to control a little bit what is already there, because we cannot think that by banning substances, these substances are going to disappear from the world. I mean, we know by experience for many years that this is not the case. So knowing that these things are going to be used no matter what by people, if they want, at least offering them a legal way to accessing this world, that is a way that also provides, for example, tax money for the entire medical system of the country, also provides money to be reinvested in education, for example, or in better drug in preparing people or informing people. So I think this system could work very well to reduce all the side effects that drugs bring to our societies nowadays, as all the criminal money surrounding them, all the adulteration, all these things in a legalized control, more not completely legal, not free market, but control system, like the pharmaceutical system that we have nowadays, could bring money back to the system, could bring very good things, as decreasing public health problems coming from illegal drug use. And and also make people more knowledgeable about drugs and to prepare them better whenever they want to take these drugs. Because I think, in my opinion, the goal of any drug policy nowadays should be to protect human health, but starting from reality, not from the ideal of, no, we're going to ban these substances and then they're going to disappear. No, we need to understand that substances are being used from many centuries because they have uses for humans. No? The uses might be more safe or more dangerous. The uses might be better or worse from our moral perspective. But of course, these things are there and they're going to be there no matter what. So we need to make a system that improves human health. And I think that having a regulated system that requires some license and also have some taxation and makes people give people an alternative, legal alternative to access these experiences, especially because these experiences, when it comes to psychedelics, can be very beneficial for individuals, even if they are not in a bad mental health condition. If they are just wanting to explore themselves or think about whatever, those substances are useful. So we need to accept that as well into the policy and offer an alternative. But I think these things need to be step by step. We should not like open tomorrow like a new system because that could be a little bit chaotic and that could backfire very easily, you know? So I think we should go step by step. And to me, the first thing to tackle is the medical use of these substances to be completely developed. All the scientific information that we need to extract still from psychedelics need to be there, and it's going to happen in the next few years. And then we can start thinking about like offering this access to people that is not in a bad mental health condition, that is just wanting to have an experience, wanting whatever. And we also can frame it for people to understand it as a preventive medicine approach. So, for example, if you had the opportunity maybe to have a psychedelic experience in a period of your life that you are having a lot of uncertainty and you need to think about things, maybe you are preventing yourself from suffering a depression 5 years later. That is, for example, what happened in my life. I had a very big, a depressive period of my life when I was completely lost. I was empty. I was motivated. I didn't know what to do with my life. And probably if I have had a psychedelic experience before that, maybe I never got into that state in the first place. Actually, psychedelics helped me to get out of that space once I was there. But I always wonder, like, what would have happened if I had taken the psychedelic before and not after? Maybe I would never got into that place in the first time.
Well, I know we've been talking for a while now, and it's very fascinating, and you've got so much good information. I wanted to ask to start kind of wrapping this up a little bit. You've got all these great ideas about what it should look like. Do you have a and I know that this is difficult, and all of this is just like based on educated guess, but in terms of like a timeline, because and in conjunction with that, there's also, I know here in the States, there are certain cities and states, I happen to be in one, where certain substances have been decriminalized. And I don't know if you, and I know that like in Portugal, I think they decriminalize things and there are certain little pockets here and there. Do you think that we're going to hit like a critical mass that is then going to create this sort of massive change? How do you see this sort of unfolding?
So I see basically like three parallel movements happening, like not at the same time, but in parallel. So there will be milestones in every of these three parallel lines. So one line is the pharmaceutical development, that is the medical development that we are seeing these days, that is the most popular line that we see, the ones that the clinical research and all these FDA meetings and all these things, no? The second line or second leg of this movement is the popular, well, the citizen side of this, no? Side of this, no? The society side of this, no? With all this decriminalization, all these legislative popular initiatives, I don't know how to say it, how you call this in the States. For example, in Europe now we have a psychedelic care that is a citizens' initiative to decriminalize, not decriminalize, but to push forward the research and the rescheduling of psychedelics that needs to achieve 1 million signatures in all Europe in order to become a reality before the year the year 2026, so before next year, we need to achieve 1 million signatures. For anyone interested in signing, that is from the European Union, you can go to psychedeliccare.au and you can sign there. And we need a lot of signatures for that. And the third, that is also very interesting, and I haven't mentioned in the interview today, is the traditional or ritual use of psychedelics. No, that is something that has been always happening outside of the Western world, in Peru, in Brazil, in Colombia, in many places where psychedelics have been used for many centuries and still being used there. And actually now they are having like an increase in popularity because of the people flowing from the West trying to seek in these experiences. No, so I think these three movements are going in parallel. No, in my opinion, in the next few years, what we're going to see is that the clinical side of it, so the first leg that I mentioned, is going to have quite big milestones, especially in big countries, no? The classic of the States and probably the European Union. In the next 2 to 3 years, probably we're going to have a major psychedelic being approved for a condition like PTSD or depression. So it's very likely that it's going to happen. And then when it comes to the citizen side of this, I think the citizen side of it is also pushing quite hard, as you know already, by the state you live in is a good example of this. In the case of the European Union, for example, there are some countries, as you mentioned, like the Portugal, or for example, the Netherlands or Spain, the country where I'm from, where you see that the drug policy has always been quite soft for allowing a lot of these things to happen, like social use of these substances in a small scale, no? But still there is not a formal approval for using them unless a few places that most of them are in the States, in the United States, as you know, no? So this is probably also something that is gonna be pushing, but I'm not sure about how successful this movement is gonna be, depending on the societies. No, for example, in Spain, I don't see this movement having success in a short time frame because the society is still quite conservative when it comes to drugs, even though the laws are not super conservative. The people mindset when it comes to thinking about authorizing the use of psychedelics, most people already don't know what it's a psychedelic. They think that it's something that makes you crazy, as you mentioned before. So it's not, the people is not ready for it. We still are arguing about medical cannabis. So I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon in Europe in particular. No? But in the States, I see that some states can in the next 2 or 3 years, some states more can join this decriminalization for psychedelics in a specific area. No? And when it comes to the third leg that I mentioned, the traditional and ritual use, this is something that has been increasing a lot in the last decades. In Spain, we have people using ayahuasca in the traditional way with shamans and with curanderos and with people from the Amazon rainforest for a long time. So this is something that has been happening for decades, actually. And this is getting quite a big traction, no? This traction is also more connected generally with the spiritual or community side of psychedelics, not so much with the pure scientific or pure psychiatric way. No, it's more connected with the spiritual, with the self-development. And this is very interesting because this is right getting into this psychedelics for healthy people trend that I thought it was going to happen afterwards, but actually is in this case in particular, it's happening at the same time. So I'm not sure how this is going to develop because, for example, in the States, you guys have some exemptions for religious use of some psychedelics, like mescaline, for example, for the Native Americans. And also in the Amazonian countries and some of the countries of South America, you also have these exemptions already in place. Here in Europe, we don't have like a lot of cultural background in the use of psychedelics. It used to be something before the Middle Ages that was commonplace, but after the Middle Ages and the expansion of the Western society as we know nowadays and the Christian societies, psychedelics disappeared from the traditional, from the culture. So we don't have any of this in place. But you guys in the States are in a very good position for also improving or making this area more accessible in the next years as these substances become more known as more safety and more useful. Probably some of the religions that had these substances on hand would be authorized to still use them in the country. No, I'm thinking about many cultures of Mexico or northern Mexico that probably have also places in the states where these cultures are being, probably this is going to make those substances even more available, but in this specific context, not for everyone, but just for the communities that are using these substances. So, as I told you, like three, I see these three going in parallel. Milestone, probably the biggest one, once is going to happen in the clinical development in the next 2 to 3 years. And also some milestones more to happen probably in the citizens initiatives and all this area, mostly in the United States. I don't see that much happening in Europe, but I don't have a doubt that from here to 10 years, we will going to be understanding psychedelics in a much more normalized and integrated way in our human health. And I hope that also in human knowledge, not only in the medical side, but also as a tool for self-development, for understanding, for reflection, or for whatever use we want to develop as a society.
Yeah. Thank you for all of that. And it's nice to think that something good will come out of the U.S. in the next 10 years.
Yeah,
we can only hope. But I think that was a good place to end. But let me ask you, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on now?
That's a very good question. I have a new book that is coming up in Spain very soon. Mm-hmm. Not sure if it's gonna go out in the States. Maybe not. I have to wait to see what happens. But anyway, it will take some long time to be, because this process has been long for this first book. So I don't have a doubt that if it happens for the second book, it's gonna be a long process anyway. So for the time being, I'm very happy with the book that we have been put into place in the state with this psychedelic reawakening that I hope is gonna be very interesting for all people there. And also I'm working a lot in social networks and in science communication. It's something that I have been doing for the last years, and now I'm getting more and more into this. I have this channel, Drogopedia, that is only in Spanish for the moment. Maybe we would develop a version in English, but for the moment it's only in Spanish. And I'm working a lot in that, no? So I'm having a lot of that, and also a lot of working in a lot of political activity regarding psychedelics. So, for example, I'm going a lot to the United Nations. I'm going a lot to the European Parliament. I'm working a lot into making, accelerating as far as I can, as much as I can, this the psychedelic development, no, especially the research, the development, and implementation. No, those three areas are the ones that I'm working most on, especially at the political level, trying to make things go faster and more efficient and deeper, and hopefully this can help all this movement to succeed in a better time frame than the other way around.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for your work. I think it is very much needed, and it's incredible that you're doing all of this. And I just want to say one more time that your book, The Psychedelic Reawakening, is an amazing text for people. And I would actually not hesitate to suggest that this is a good starter book for people to get, you know, really solid information about the psychedelic uses, in particular from a therapeutic aspect. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of the research that's there, and it's an incredible resource. So again, thank you so much for that.
Thank you very much, Nick. It was a big pleasure. And it's exactly what you said. I mean, I wrote this book especially for people that is interested in this area and they want to get into it and understand everything, like as a starting guide for actually the original title of the book before it was translated to English, the title was The Essential Guide for the Psychedelic Renaissance. That was the original title before it was translated into English, and this new title that is better in terms of not having so much conflicts with other titles that are already in the market in the United States. Yeah. So, but the idea is to have a guide that can bring someone from zero to a good, very good understanding of everything related with the psychedelic world, no? The history of the psychedelics, the drug classification, how they work in the brain, the psychedelic, all these therapeutic uses, the future of the substances, harm reduction tools and techniques for people interested in doing them by their own at home or whatever. So that was the main goal. And thank you very much, because I found this very, very, very funny, very enjoyable, and very, very nice. This interview. It's been a long time since I didn't give an interview in English, so I hope you would understand everything I said. But
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was perfect.
It was a big pleasure.
It was perfect. Yeah. So thank you again so much. I really appreciated the conversation and look forward to what you're doing next. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. Big pleasure.
All right. And that's a wrap on episode 182 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, my faithful listeners know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, please. Share this with friends and family and on social media, too. Subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following, those are all free, and it only takes a few seconds of your time, and they really do help. Subscriber numbers are important, as are followers on podcast platforms. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. A lot of work goes into creating each episode, several hours each week. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, very slow going. But your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, and the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nourish your rebel spirit.